Hello and welcome to my podcast. It's Jannie Organically on the Very, Very Quite Contrary podcast. And today I'm talking to my doctor, Dr. Young from Young Wellness Center in Los Gatos, California. She and I have built a relationship over the past 5 years, and she's become somebody that completely knows my health history in and out and has gone through the ups and downs of my hormonal imbalances and now onto some issues I've been having with blood sugar and borderline diabetes and working through my diet and, in fact, coming to a place of kind of stress for me because I have such what I thought was such a good relationship with food, having to look at food a little bit differently and learn through that. And so she's going to come on and explain all the stuff that stressed me out, and hopefully she can help you as well. Of course, we are going to talk a little bit more about naturopathic doctors and how they are looking at things differently than maybe a more mainstream doctor, but also how you can use your more conventional doctor in a way to help you get where you need if they are willing to run some tests for you. So we'll get into all of that here on the podcast. All right. So Dr. Young, thank you for joining me today on this new podcast of mine.
Absolutely.
You and I have known each other for quite some time. And in fact, I started my first appointment with you. I didn't even know I was pregnant yet. I was just a few days pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I think it was my husband's first experience with a different type of doctor, somebody who takes like hour and a half intro appointments to ask all of the necessary questions that go outside of the typical symptoms and genetics of like, what did your parents have? And to kind of get to the root of, you know, I was talking to you about things that happened to me as a child that made a lot of sense into what was going on in my body with hormonally. And, but my husband became, you know, a huge fan when he started to see you because every time he went to see you, you always told him some problem he was having. He just needed more sex. And so he definitely is a fan.
I think he made that up a little bit just to let you know.
he comes home. He's like, oh, yep, it's more sex. That's so the funny answer, Dr. Young said. And so because we've worked together specifically for my PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and a lot of hormonal imbalance that was going on in my body and bringing me back from the brink of postpartum and raging hormones in my body. And so anytime I felt a surge of maybe unsolicited anger or irritation, I always chalked it up to, I'm sorry, it's my hormones, sorry, I've got a hall pass for that. But more recently, we've been looking at my hormones and they're, you know, pretty much in order. And you're like, no, it's not that anymore. You have some issues with your insulin sensitivity, some reactive hypoglycemia. And so, yeah, I wanted to bring you on to talk about how my eating habits had impacted what was going on with my blood sugar levels and putting me basically borderline diabetic. And I considered myself to be eating very healthy. I had stopped eating animal products. I was eating mostly veggies. And but something I had never done before was count anything like in terms of carbs or calories. I was more of an intuitive eater. I'm eating lots of veggies, but I was also eating a lot of potatoes and rice to make up for maybe the heaviness of meat. And so I wanted to bring you on and kind of talk through what was going on in my body, maybe some of the symptoms that might help other people recognize what might be happening in them. And also to take any of the heat for any of the people that are going to be mad that I had to have some meat to kind of help myself get back on track.
Absolutely. Well, I often think about our first visit is actually one of my favorite patient appointments because it was hilarious. I had this amazing plan for you to get better. And here unbeknownst to both of us, you're pregnant. So yes. it was pretty hilarious. So we've been through quite a journey together in that sense. And I want to like first just really commend you, because when it comes to PCOS, it is one of the most common hormonal problems that women have. I mean, something like 6 to 12% of women suffer from PCOS. I mean, it's almost 1 out of 10 have mm-hmm. some form of PCOS. So first, I want to just kind of like define, when you have PCOS and you have a syndrome, it's different for each person. So it's generally a problem with too high of androgens, so testosterone, DHEA, more like male hormones in women, some mm-hmm. level of insulin resistance, and then some problems with like ovarian function that might reduce your estrogen levels. So with you, you have just done such a fabulous job of taking control of your health. I think you actually went in the other direction. And I see this happen a lot with women who are really take charge types like you are and committed to being well and really taking care of themselves. So I just feel like you have explored diet and everything so far that you then went to a more vegan type diet, and it really messed with that insulin portion of your PCOS. So we can definitely talk a lot more about that and diet and the whys, but I want to make sure that we really frame that when it comes to PCOS, there's a sex hormone mm-hmm. aspect, and then there's a blood sugar regulating hormone aspect. So that blood sugar dysregulation in PCOS, it's an exaggerated way that your body responds to insulin. So insulin is like an escort service for sugar. And this is why your husband loves to come and see me, because I can talk about things in ways we can all understand.
Like escorts?
Like escorts. So now we're talking about
escorts. It's funny, because you and I can talk about hormones like really in complicated fashion. But when you're talking about insulin resistance, I feel so dumb. So I had to like, can you explain that to me? Like I'm a 10-year-old. And then you do. And I'm like, all right, let's pretend that I'm 5. Let's try again. Because it was so confusing to me. I'm like, wait, my blood sugar's high. My blood sugar's low. What is happening?
Absolutely. And it is confusing. And I think it's important to break health down to people in a way that they can understand it. Because, you know, obviously, I can say a lot of big words and stuff, and it's, you know, sadly, people will just lose me. So really important to get what insulin does. So insulin acts as an escort service and says, hey, sugar, let's get in the cell and make some energy, right? Come on, baby, let's get in there together. So in most women with PCOS, what ends up happening is their body fat keeps going up. So that's why typical PCOS patients have a lot of, you know, obesity within their midsection. So they accumulate fat around their abdomen, because sugar is trying to help you get energy. So in its process of being like, hey, baby, let's go. Mm-hmm. Instead, your body doesn't actually need the sugar to metabolize. And that's where women start to struggle with weight issues. So insulin resistance is essentially your pancreas's inability to understand when insulin should be secreted. So it's almost like unwanted sexual advances. And again, right. I like to make it like we can really understand it. Like, hey, baby, let's get on and let's do this. And your body is like, hell no, I don't need any extra energy. I already have enough.
Right.
So that's where insulin becomes resistant, and it keeps pressing and keeps telling you that you need more and more, and then you just keep accumulating more weight.
Now, and so is the goal to educate the pancreas?
To some level, when someone has PCOS, it's more to learn how to eat the right way so that your pancreas can't make advances. And I'm so sorry, men, you have to treat it like a man. You have to take it down to the most simplistic thing. Like, how can you not make your husband fail? Like, you know, leave the laundry basket in front of the bed so he trips over it and gets the side. Oh, yeah, I meant to do laundry today. So we have to make it like really easy for your body to understand. So, you know, and this is kind of where protein balance comes in. So, you know, fiber and protein are really important in blood sugar regulation. So fiber, which is part of vegetables, slows the absorption of sugar. So when you eat resistant starches or you eat high fiber foods, then your body understands, okay, I only get a little bit of sugar at a time. So, you know, I can't let insulin just shove this all in so quickly. I'll get it a little bit more slowly. And then insulin learns like, okay, I can't be too eager. And I really don't know why everything turns into me like a sex conversation. It's like, if you're too eager, it just doesn't happen.
Right.
It's like, we can't be too eager here. We have to slow it down. And then protein helps you to build more muscle, and it also keeps your blood sugar stable, so it doesn't give insulin permission to advance. So that's why protein is so important. And when you have, you know, I'm very respectful of vegetarian and vegan diets. I personally think a lot about my food, which I'd like to get into with you a little bit today. You know, for some people's health conditions, it's really hard to maintain that. I'm not saying that you can't, but it takes such a level of difficulty, and especially like as a busy mom, et cetera, sometimes it just doesn't pan out for you to do that. So
right, and I think when you told me this in the beginning appointment, and I like was borderline in tears because food seems to be what I didn't realize is a level of stress if I have to really pay attention to what I'm eating versus what I had been doing, which is more intuitive in what am I drawn to today? And not like, it's like, I'm going to, you know, crush the refined carbohydrates or refined sugar. But, I felt like I was eating a balanced diet in terms of like, just tons of veggies. And, what I didn't realize was a problem was complex carbohydrates. And so when you're telling me I need to lower my carbs, I'm like, I don't even know what carbs are. I don't even know how much a sweet potato has versus a regular potato versus rice. And so I didn't understand the process of carbohydrates turning into sugar. And so the first reaction to me was, it was just very overwhelming because I felt like I had a very healthy relationship with food, and now I have to go and obsess over the nutrition label and versus I'm more ingredient and quality focused. And so with the carb thing, so there was initial, I'm stressed out about I have to pay attention to these things. And then the second part was, a lot of people, what I've talked to, some of the people who do keto, or they've gone through removing the carbs from their life, they go through what's called the carb flu or the keto flu. Mm-hmm. And so like the first week was awful. Like I had very bad headaches. I felt like I was thinking about food all the time, and I just felt sickly. And then at the end of the week, I felt like I had come through it. So I feel like the first week was the hardest in terms of removing the complex carbs, because there was a heaviness that was missing from my food. I would just eat and eat and eat until I felt like something heavy in my stomach. And so I felt like it was impossible to get through that first week without eating meat. But now that I've been doing it for several weeks or even over a month, I think at this point, I'm finding that it's a lot easier because I've been through the initial stress of the idea behind it. And I've been through the carb flu, and I've been, I'm finding that I'm craving less. I'm not even missing the carbs. I'm not missing the rice. I'm not missing the potatoes. And so I'm able to focus on just eating mostly veggies, and I'm able to kind of wean the meat out, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I want to kind of like just, you know, back up and give you a little bit of my perception of food. And it's just so interesting to me because I think that people have gotten, we've gotten really, really weird about food and how we perceive food. So I just kind of want to address, and I know, again, the same as you, I try to be really sensitive to like people's opinions. So guys, everyone's got an opinion. I'm just going to throw mine down there. So I come from a very big like hunting, fishing, farming background. So I literally grew up on my grandparents' farm, you know, picking vegetables, canning, etc. So I think as human beings, we've completely lost seasonality, sense of food, how we should eat. We become so obsessed with like what's the right food. We've just kind of stopped making sense. So I think I've mentioned a little bit before how I really try to just like throw it out there, and I know not everyone is going to believe the same thing and think the same things, but really I think that you have to have a balanced diet that goes within a season and seasonality. So I don't walk into the woods and see piles and piles of fat everywhere. Right. I don't walk into the woods and see bags of food. So I try to be really logical about just what makes sense. So from a sensibility standpoint, you have to think about, you know, green things and small animals are the things that you would see if you walked out into the woods. And I know this particularly from when I go hunting. So if I'm going large animal hunting, like for a deer or a moose or an elk, I first will see a low load of small animals and green things. So I have to believe, like, a more natural diet would be to sit and snack on green stuff, maybe a couple nuts and seeds, a little bit of fruit if I were lucky, and I would have to, you know, accept that I would eat smaller things. So when I'm looking at health, I'm trying not to just look at how can I manipulate food because I can afford it and because I can eat it, but what actually makes sense for your body. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of good friends that are vegans, actually one of my best friends, and her and I talk a lot about how we both feel like people that think about food are our favorite type of people, even if we disagree with what they choose to do with their food. So there's that aspect of health and having a healthy relationship with what you're doing. So if you're uncomfortable with the thought of eating an animal or killing an animal for food, that's going to make it more difficult for you to be healthy because of the level of stress involved in it. Does that make sense? So it's kind of like a, right. You know, that's a thing, and stress is really a thing. But, you know, you have to kind of figure out, are you a person that has the genetics, the, you know, hormonal situation, etc., that you can make choices just because you emotionally feel something. And I think that that's kind of where you came to as a place. And I, you know, would like your interjection here, is that you have your ethical, moral, like, thinking brain, and then you have the fact that you have PCOS and the fact that you have some of these other blood sugar relating problems, and you've had to marry the two. Mm-hmm. So is that about...
Well, yes, and I think my daughter was the one who basically initiated us, like, removing meat from our diet, because I've always been a big proponent of listening to kids' intuition, and what I was starting to realize that as I was giving her solid food, she never ate the meat, and I would force her to eat it, and she would, like... She is very compliant and very joyful little girl, but she would spit it out. She's like, I didn't want it. And then I don't know if it was just that that kind of impacted me, that it was chicken first. I could not look at chicken. I started to, like, just be repulsed by it. And so then it was like a very slow, gradual, just meat kind of disappeared from our household. Mm-hmm. And I know that, I don't know what your thoughts are on just bioindividuality and our ancestors and where they grew up. Did they grow up hunting elk and deer, or did they grow up, you know, in the Arctic eating blubber? And, like, what does that really affect what is best for our biology today, even though they're probably, like, crossbred with people who ate everything if you go back far enough?
Absolutely. Well, and I think really when we're looking at it, you know, it really comes down to what people used to eat and people used to do isn't practical anymore, because they also didn't sit on their ass all day at a computer. I mean, and I'm going to kind of bring up here what everyone talks about in terms of the French paradigm. They talk about how the French can eat butter and fat and do all these things and not gain weight. Well, I was in France recently, and a day of walking under 16,000 steps was a lazy day. Right. So you have to marry motion with food and seasonality with food. And I do mm-hmm. think your genetics makes a difference. And a great example of that is one of my really great friends. She's Vietnamese and I'm Italian. Well, I can drink a ton of wine and she can't. You can't deny that there is not a biological difference there between people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting perspective when you're looking at food and how we relate to it. So, yes, I think that your genetics matter. And I think that as an individual, you have to kind of figure out what that means for you. So if you come to my house and I'm drinking a couple glasses of wine and your body can't metabolize that, well, that's a problem.
Right.
But for me, my HDL, my good quality cholesterol, actually goes up with wine. I'm one of those people. But if I drink other alcohols, like bourbon or something, my blood sugar gets crazy. So, like, you have to kind of figure out, you know, what does it all mean? And sometimes the answer isn't necessarily in a genetic test. It's kind of like you're the experiment.
Right.
So when they told me I was going to practice medicine, I thought, this is complete BS. I just paid $200,000 for my brain. You're going to tell me I can't just do this? Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. What I realized... My patients, you guys are the experiment. So I know we're, you know, in terms of talking about you here today, you're one of my people where, you know, you build muscle like it's your job. So I think you probably tolerate a slightly lower protein diet, even though you still need it, than other people. And you know, at the same time, there are other patients that couldn't build muscle as easy as you could, even if they tried. And I'll go back to like that super like yogic type body. Well, that's not your body type. It's not mine either. You have a very athletic build. So as long as you're getting a sufficient amount of protein for your body, I think that you're fine. There are other people that need an obscene amount of protein to try to accomplish goals that they have or to overcome health issues that they're having. Right. So when it comes to insulin resistance, protein and fats help to stabilize your blood sugar, and carbohydrates destabilize them if they're not a resistant starch or high fiber food. So that's kind of, I think, what the crux of what we're talking about today is: how do you resolve those issues, and what is it that you can do for you as an individual to figure out what's right?
Right. And I think whenever I go and do my test to see what's going on after having removed these the amount of carbs complex or otherwise I've removed from my diet, I'm a little bit concerned that my cholesterol is going to have gone up based on, you know, my intake over a certain amount of time of meat or fat, if you will. And back to the ethical side of things, in terms of, you're talking about, I know you go out and you hunt your food, and most people aren't. And a lot of my readers and our listeners are very conscious about where they're sourcing their food, and they're looking for, if they do eat meat, they're looking for the pasture raised, grass fed. Although that all gets tricky too, because that doesn't mean that they are not treated with antibiotics, and you know, that's a problem too if you're not eating quality meat. So if your body wants meat, the quality and type, I think, matters just as much.
It absolutely does. And there are great meat co-ops and resources that you can get your food from. I have patients that do things like go in on a, you know, side of beef together. And I'm not, obviously, I totally get most people are not willing to do what I do. I mean, I've actually been off of commercial meat since about 2006. So, I mean, it's not always easy. And there are some years that are slimmer than others. And there are years when I have a ton of extra protein in my freezer. So, you know, it's like I go salmon fishing. That's something that a lot of people actually have access to in the Bay Area. Places like Costco and Whole Foods and some of these places, they do have some great ethical choices for meat. I don't want to knock them because I think they can have amazing food sources. But again, you know, like you said, understand when you're talking about like chicken in particular, when something has access to the outside, I mean, I have chickens and they're pretty dumb. They might just have like a little hole and an access to an outside area, but they won't leave the barn unless something forces them out. So that's sometimes when they say free range, it doesn't mean they've actually been in a range and running around.
It's a sense of frustration for me too, because people see free range or cage free, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything except that they're all just wandering around inside of a barn, really, in each other's feces, and don't have access to outside. But you were mentioning, you know, your bounty being bigger some years than others, which seem more like what hunter-gatherer days were like originally, that you wouldn't have meat with every single meal and bacon at every breakfast, and you got what you got and you made it last for a long time.
Absolutely. And that's something that people just don't seem to get, is that it isn't that you can have whatever you want whenever you want. And, you know, bacon is a great example. I mean, bacon is essentially a small little portion of the abdominal muscles of a pig. So you wouldn't be able to have five slices of bacon every time you felt like it, because that was what was on your, you know, keto plan, or, you know, milk wouldn't spontaneously squirt out of cows to make cheese whenever you wanted either. So I think that that kind of food logic that we've lost is really frustrating, especially as a naturopathic doctor, that people don't, you know, take their bones and make bone broth out of it. And they don't do all of these extra things to actually utilize everything that you would have sourced. And in that same breath, I'm a busy mom and I get it's not always practical. So you can mimic a bounty by using things that you get at the grocery store. Like if you can't make bone broth, then buy some. You know, if you feel like you want to eat bacon, great. Do it once every couple months. I mean, it's not a daily activity. So it's just one of those interesting things for me.
Right. And yeah, so the whole paleo approach seems to be, and I think paleo is basically a version of Atkins, right? It's just mostly meat and no dairy, veggies. Yes.
But Atkins allowed dairy. Atkins was kind of like a morph between paleo and keto. Paleo, if you're really doing it the right way, it's no dairy, no grains, no beans. So I can't completely agree with the no beans for sure. I'm not a big dairy fan. I don't really advocate people eat dairy in any kind of high demand. And just to kind of like aside, it's always fascinating to me from an animal cruelty standpoint that people will not eat meat, but they'll happily eat cheese and eggs. And I'm kind of like, I don't really know if I was forced to lactate and ovulate, if I would want to just die or not, but I probably would. So yeah. I'm not a big fan of those things in general, but, you know, again, in small amounts, I think they can be appropriate for some people, especially like my husband is of, you know, a Norwegian background and like he has no problem with dairy. I'm Mediterranean and I'm literally genetically lactose intolerant. So it makes it easier for me to feel that way. But I mean, really looking at how your food is sourced, it's an important part of health and kind of wrapping back around to like blood sugar stabilization and other things. If you're doing paleo the right way in terms of eating, you know, meat and lots of veggies, that can be really great. I like the Mediterranean diet in terms of an add-in of lots of legumes. And if you're going to have fats, make sure that they're good quality fats and they're not from, you know, an animal source. Keto is a little more, like some keto people are really very like cheese heavy. You know, I'm not as into that. I think if you're going to do keto, you should do it on more of a vegan diet than you should a, animal fat diet. So use your fats from food sources that are plant-based. I think that's much better for you. But, you know, I'm definitely a fan of people including some animal protein in their diet if they have blood sugar regulating problems.
And, you know, when you're talking about keto, that's, you're eating a certain amount of carbs per day or per hour or per meal, but you're also fasting.
Well, and this is where things get really confusing because everyone has their own version of a diet. So in general, keto is 60% fat and anywhere from 20 to 30% carbs, 20 to 30% protein, depending on who you ask. Well, a ketogenic diet was originally developed for people who had epilepsy and neurological problems. So it's always fascinating that then that was morphed into a weight loss program. Right. So if you're doing keto, keto has nothing to do with intermittent fasting or delayed food. That's a more modernized version of it. And I'm definitely a fan of eating all of your calories within like about an 8-hour window. So to talk a little more about blood sugar regulation, actually, I want to bring up a case I have, and she's another one of my humans, very much like you, that I absolutely adore, who is so committed to her health. And she has diabetes and she decided she would do keto and she would do intermittent fasting. And so she was taking herself up to 24, 30 hour fast, and her hemoglobin A1C, which is a marker that shows your blood sugar over the last 3 months, started to go up. And I explained to her that your body will go through a process of breaking down muscle tissue to make sugar if your blood sugar gets so too low. So the process is called gluconeogenesis. So sugar from a new source. So the sugar will actually come from breaking down your muscle. And that's not healthy either. Mm-hmm. So this is where we get into people do things, and you know, that balance of not being susceptible to the marketing of health is really, it's really hard. I mean, even as a doc who promotes health, I'm like, that sounds fantastic. We should do more. And I'm like, crap, no, we shouldn't do more. We should do just enough. So to me, like 16-hour fasts are perfect for people. Eating within an 8-hour window works great for most people. If you have more reactive hypoglycemia, like you do, if you're eating all of your food in one dose and your blood sugar spikes and then you drop down, you become hangry, you're not a nice person, you're being mean to people, then that might not be a good thing for you to do. You might want to think about eating in a 10-hour period instead. So that's kind of, you know, you have to shift for your own health. And it goes back to, I'm such an advocate, and you know this about me, of people looking at their labs every 6 months to a year and seeing what's true for me and what strategy works for me. Not what's the thing my hairdresser thinks I should do, or what worked for my neighbor. What should I do for
me? Right. And I think that's probably one of my bigger points from an advocate perspective, is to do what works for you. And all of these diets and these fads, and they're like, people are very religious about them and promote them as, this worked for me, therefore it will work for you. And that's not how it works. And so how can they tell if it's working for them? And maybe in a 18-hour fasts aren't the best for them. Maybe it's more of a 14 or 16-hour fast is better for them. And maybe like, how would they be able to tell the difference without having like their blood drawn every day to see if what they were doing was working?
Absolutely. Well, I think you kind of teed me up perfectly, because there's always a question I have for people, like why diet in the first place, right? Like, why choose a diet? Why not just, you know, eat whatever you want to eat? Like, it's a real question. So the why for people, I think, is what you have to ask first. Like in your situation, the why is because you have hormonal problems.
Yeah.
Right. For other people, the why might be that they just want to lose weight. Other people might just want to live longer. So there's different reasons for doing things. So if we're talking strictly about for your health, like in a situation like yours, if you're gaining weight and it doesn't make sense to you, then what you're doing probably isn't working. If you're completely fatigued and you don't have energy, what you're doing probably isn't working, right? If you're in a bitchy mood 24/7 and no one wants to be around you, what you're doing isn't working. And it might be that it's not working because of an underlying health issue. So if you're super OCD about it, yes, you'd have to, you know, measure your blood sugar constantly and do all those things. I don't think that's that important for people to do. So I'd really like people to reframe their brains and start from a perspective of, what are my health goals? Like, do I just want to live longer? Do I want to have better athletic performance? Do I want to help a disease or condition I have? And choose what you should do from that space, as opposed to just, you know, coming up with something that you think is just the, like, this is just the right thing for me to do. So I just have a different bent.
Right. And so, and for my case specifically, I feel like I went through that drastic kind of dietary change to kind of bring me as far back from the brink of going over the edge into diabetes. And because I feel like something like diabetes, once you go over the edge, you can't really reverse it, can you?
Well, and that's something that you and I have chatted about before. You know, can you reverse insulin resistance? Can you reverse diabetes? There are autoimmune forms of diabetes and insulin resistance that are much more difficult. So I want to make sure I'm being clear about what I'm talking about. If you have a insulin dysregulation induced from a standard Western living, we call it a SAD diet, a standard American diet, and from overeating. Yeah, that's actually what's called a SAD diet. If you're on the SAD diet, then that's something you can completely reverse. Clearly, if you have other genetic factors or things that contribute to your blood sugar problems, then that's going to be a little bit harder for you to do. I don't want to like totally ADD, but there's like, we talk a lot about viruses like Epstein-Barr virus or mycoplasma or Lyme attacking different areas of people's bodies and causing it so that they can't actually, you know, regulate energy the same way, or they have chronic fatigue. And so there are things that can happen to people that can make it really hard, right? Or they have autoimmune diabetes, or there's another condition called MODY, which has to do with another, like, you know, intermittent, you know, diabetic type problem. So with that said, again, yeah, you have to know why you have problems. There is no way of getting around that. And I like to use the analogy of retirement. So if I said to you, I want to retire, but I'm not going to tell you what I make or how I'd like to live or any of my goals, and I want you to help me. you'd be like, this lady is flipping crazy. I feel the same way about people when they're like, I have health goals, but I'm not going to bother knowing anything about my body. I'm like, that's just, it's just stupid talk. Like, just like, I don't even want to talk to people like that. I'm like, you're just so ignorant. I can't stand it. Like, I just want to shake you, and I'm not supposed to, because I'm a doctor and I'm supposed to be a really kind human. And I am, but I'm like, get a grip, people. You got to know what's going on with your body.
Right.
And you can't just like, you know, blast other people for what they're doing when you're not them. And this is what gets into some of that, like, you know, you should eat meat, you should not eat meat, you should do this, you should do that. Well, you know, it's just like a relationship or a financial situation. You're not someone else. So I don't think making judgments on people for what they're doing is really helping anyone. Like, you know, it's not really about you, what someone else is doing. You need to make what's about you. And I tell my patients this all the time. You know, don't look in other places for answers. Look at yourself. I mean, really, like, true success is within yourself. If you want to succeed at a diet, you have to figure out what's going to work for you. And, you know, consulting with someone that's going to help you look at some of that stuff, I honestly don't know how else someone does it. I mean, I clearly wouldn't be in the profession I'm in if I thought that that was normal. And I'm in my mid 40s right now, and I started seeing a naturopathic doctor when I was 19. So I'm over 25 years into this. This isn't like I just woke up yesterday and started thinking about it. And not to be rude to those of you that are writing books and other things about your experiences, but I see a lot of times people taking advice from someone that it's like they woke up 3 months ago and decided to write this book or something, and now everyone's following it, and this person has no experience with health. They don't know much about people's chemistry, and sometimes it can be damaging. And I think about your condition, like with PCOS, and how you're right. You were at a point of pre-diabetic, and then you pushed yourself to almost reactive hypoglycemia, and now you have to find
Well, another thing that you and I had talked about before is, you know, one of my reactions was I thought I had this all under control. Like, we dealt with this in the beginning. This was like 2 or 3 years ago. My insulin sensitivity has kind of, you know, come down, and now it's back. And so you were kind of explaining to me, well, it's not necessarily back. Like, your body, it's aging, it's doing all these things, and you have to kind of change with, you know, with your body as you age.
Absolutely. And so I think I might have said to you, like, and it's kind of funny, like, no matter how smart someone is, how pretty they are, or how much money they have, your hormones decline. You know, the body was made to destruct. Like it or not, it starts brand new and it ends not brand new. So we have to change with that. So, and this is what you and I talk a lot about, you know, genetics and epigenomics, and how you're basically given a roadmap when you're born. And the roadmap is your genetics. And let's just say for you, you have PCOS on your map. Whether or not you get there by a highway or a slow hiking trail depends on how you live. That's what epigenomics are, how we choose to live that triggers our genetics or our genes on and off. So if we were to assume that there's some genetic component to PCOS, and we don't know exactly what it is, but there seems to be some genetic component to PCOS, then you choosing to eat a particular way can make you take that path more quickly or more slowly. So kind of, you know, looping back around to like insulin levels and how your body changes, as your estrogen levels decline and your estrogen levels change, your metabolism changes. You know, women say all the time, oh, I went through menopause and I got all this fat around my midsection. Well, why do you think that is? It's because estrogen is a steroid, just like testosterone is a steroid. It helps us keep muscle. The less muscle mass that you have, the more body fat you have. The more fat you have, the more you can actually trigger insulin problems and blood sugar regulating problems. So that's where those two guys kind of relate in a normal aging process. And you see somewhere between the early 30s and the mid 40s, most of us will start to experience some level of hormonal declines. You're always going to have your outliers and your people that don't experience that until they're 50 or 60s, but those are few and far between. Most of us will start to suffer that by the time we're somewhere between 35 and 42.
And, you know, I think you had told me, and another hormone specialist had told me, just based on, you know, my history and how I was presenting, that I would probably experience an early perimenopause or early menopause. And so when I hit 35, I think psychologically I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's just get it over with. And so at 35, 36, I think I'm 36, my body is actually changing. Like, it's like that weird magical number that everybody talks about, that something shifted around this age.
It's really, you know, I've been in medicine for a long time and I really wish it wasn't true, but I joke often that I wish I could go back and give people different advice. When I started practicing medicine at 27, I gave terrible advice. I'm like, well, you know, if you want to lose weight, you just stop drinking beer all the time. I'm like, what's this lady, a boozer? What's wrong with her? You just listen, lady, right, don't eat right. for a day. What's wrong with you? You know, and then you progress and you realize, oh, smack, this is not as easy as I thought it was. And metabolism isn't as easy. And, you know, PCOS in general and people who suffer from, what's referred to as androgen dominance. So you have your dominant with like more like testosterone, than estrogen levels often when you have PCOS. That extra hormone actually floods your ovaries and reduces them from working as well. And you know, ironically, again, for you and I first meeting and not even knowing you were pregnant, women who have PCOS often have fertility problems and they don't get pregnant easily. So I'll also see a slightly earlier menopause in women that have PCOS. So, you know, what you're saying in terms of experience is absolutely correct for women who are in their mid 30s, but also I think PCOS compounds it, and that's why you felt such an extreme shift.
You know, me and my personality, I've never been subtle about anything, and so my body is that way too. It just goes from one extreme to the next. I'm reflective of that.
Absolutely.
So when you're talking about, you know, like you are, as well as I am, a very big advocate for people to take charge of their health. So they can, if they have somebody that they can talk to about the stuff or get some blood work done, like what would you recommend they request? Because I do remember on our first appointment, I was on a Kaiser plan, and you said, well, it's actually going to be less expensive for you to request it from them, have it run through your insurance, and, you know, cross your fingers they don't say no. And I was lucky enough that the doctor there like would run all the blood work that you had asked for. I mean, this was a lot of hormone stuff. But either A, somebody like find a naturopathic doctor, or B, kind of maybe consult with someone like you and request your labs be run, or you can send them a kit. Like what would be like a first step for somebody who's like, I want to understand what's going on in my body and in terms of hormones and food and how to eat the best way for me.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, if you have a great relationship with your primary care doctor, you can always go to them and say, you know, I want to have all of my hormones checked. I want to have my, you know, blood sugar regulation checked, and I want to do all of these things. But this is kind of understanding that most of us, you have sick care insurance. You don't have health care insurance. So to be healthy often, you know, takes finding someone that will advocate that for you. So naturopathic doctors are a great resource. There are a lot of great functional medicine doctors and osteopaths and even some chiropractors that do things that are very similar to what I do. We do see patients remotely in my clinic. I've helped a fair number of people come up with a strategy or a plan. So mine usually includes what food is best for your body, what nutrient deficiencies might you have, getting a full thyroid panel done, full sex hormone panel done, and what's called a cardiometabolic profile, including all of your inflammatory markers. So, I mean, it's funny that I'm going to bring your husband up again. So it's like, it's that funny thing, like that shock of like, I can't believe you did all of these things, you know, like, wow, look at all this stuff that people do and actually look at. And I see a lot of really smart people and executives and stuff, and they want what's referred to as an executive wellness check. And that's really what I do. And from a health standpoint, I've really realized my job is to be a strategist for people. My job is to come up with a plan that fits you and tell you how to implement it. And sometimes you're implementing it with another person, and sometimes you're implementing it with other staff in my office. But really, you have to come up with a strategy. And I also really advocate that you talk to your family about family history, because sometimes what you think is family history is not actually true. Remember that, you know, it's funny, it says, I didn't think the internet would even take off, and I'm not that old. Like, people didn't have technology the way they do today. So if I talked to my grandmother and said, what did Auntie Nini die of? She'd say something crazy like, she died in the night when her when her cat left, and actually her husband cheated on her and she became an alcoholic and she drank herself to death. But I'm never going to hear that. Right. So I think she had a heart attack. Cause I'm like, oh, she got scared. She had a heart attack. I don't know what my grandmother's talking about. So realizing anyone that's really over the age of, you know, 45, 50, your family history is only good as medicine was when you had it. Does that make sense? So that's why some of this genetic testing becomes so important. So also test some of the genetic factors for, you know, heart disease, you know, some of the genetic factors for stroke, Alzheimer's disease, you can get some really easy genetic testing for. And there are some other really neat things that you can do around your genetics and your estrogen metabolism. You can do genetics and cancer markers. I mean, all kinds of cool stuff. And just get like a great basic map of like, okay, what does my map look like?
On some of my blood work, there were those genetic markers that said, like, you're the type of person who wouldn't do well on this medication. Should you go into like an emergency room and they want to give you this heart medication, like, you won't respond well to that, or that would actually be bad for you. And so that's helpful. Then there's another side of the genetic, just like your like mutations. If we've talked about MTHFR, which you could not pay me to say the whole word, but the MFR gene. And, but, you know, even though like Sawyer and I have share some of the same mutations, like mine are more concerning than hers, or I need to be more cautious of mine because of other genetic factors. And so we're all like different human beings, like in terms of what our DNA and genetics look like, even if we're even in the same family, which is another stressor for me. Cause I'm like, well, that means my husband might eat different than me. Like, we're used to like, you know, we share the same meals, we share the same dinners. And, you know, as I've been, during the first couple of weeks of me like going really meat heavy, cause I'm like, I'm not going to be a diabetic. He's like, yeah, I can't eat that. It's too much meat for me. And so I've been like, all three of us have been eating differently, which was another source of like, oh my gosh, this is kind of hard to manage.
It is really hard to manage when you're all eating different for different people. But I mean, I think if we look at it from the standpoint of, you know, there's carbs, proteins, and fats. We, you know, some of us burn one fuel better than the other, right? You, when you're making meals, you kind of have to think about, make something for everyone and make sure that the thing that's the best for that person, they're getting more of than
proportions
you.
Proportions are different.
Right? So that's, you know, kind of an interesting, very, very different. I think you can do it. And again, it just comes down to, you know, strategy. It's like you have to either sit down. It's like, think about it like cleaning your house. You either have to sit down and do it yourself, or you have to pay somebody else to do it.
Right.
Either way, you can't let it go filthy. So if you're looking at it from the standpoint of you have to figure something out, you know, you're a great person in terms of you are like resource lady. You're like, I'm going to get resources for everything. I'm going to learn about this, learn about that. You know, some people just don't have it in them to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's anything from like health coaches, nutritionists that will sit down and help you come up with a plan for your whole family. I'm more of a, you know, I'm a functional medicine geek. So I like to look at more of the genetics and other things. And it's so funny that you mentioned MTHFR, because my husband always jokes it's a reason why I don't have friends sometimes, because if I've had enough to drink, I will say methyl ethyl tetrahydrofolate reductase enzymes and nutrigenomics and see who wants to actually talk to me.
It would be me.
I know, right? It's so funny. So those types of, you know, genetic variations, and that's one that's very popular and people talk about it a lot, but there are so many other influences on that gene. So like if you have an MTHFR gene and you also have an MTRR gene or a BHT gene or a COMT gene, it influences it differently. So this also, I mean, very much like marketing and just choosing a diet. Sometimes people know one or two things and they change their whole life based on it without looking at the picture. Like I can be confident with you. Like I've looked at a lot of your stuff and you're doing fantastic and you're doing all the right things. You know, you're just having to work through
aging.
Normal, like physiological changes with the roadmap you've been given. Exactly. Exactly, friend. Exactly. So, you know, it's just, you know, life changes. And I think, you know, taking it with stride and trying to not, you know, be too stressed about it is also really important, because stress will raise your cortisol levels,
right, exactly.
Which also affects insulin levels.
In the position I was, might find this overwhelming and like, where do I start? I need to find a doctor. I need to get, you know, a hold of this and figure out what's going on and fix everything right now. Cause that's where I was at. And so it was causing a lot more stress in my life to like, I need to get better. And I'm over there trying to research and I'm like driving myself crazy cause I'm diving down into, these rabbit holes. And so it was a sense of relief to like kind of like dump it onto you and be like, okay, here's all the data, like help me work through this. But also through that process and running, you know, not just me, but my family's blood work and genetics. And I'll use my husband as an example again. And I won't get specific because he's not here and I'm going to blast his whole health history on to the interwebs, but he tested positive for a specific, gene that said he was going to be more likely to experience XYZ. Well, you know, it was like a couple years later, he started experiencing XYZ, which would be concerning, would have concerned me and freaked me out. But I'm like, oh, I was expecting this. So let me just email Dr. Young and have her prescribe you, you know, this, you know, quick vitamin. And then it was all better. But because I felt like I was so prepared, I could have gone, you know, so far over the edge of like freaking out about these symptoms that I'm like, oh, no, I got this. I already know what's going on.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's just, you are very fortunate that you have a personal relationship with a doctor like me. And I've known you guys for a long time now. So it does make it easier. And I think you kind of bring up something that's like really, I'm really feel very strongly about. A lot of people don't realize, you know, having a relationship with a doctor long term, that's the way that they know you. Like, you could call me on a dime about you, right, your husband, or your daughter, and I'm like, oh, boom, do this. But if I only talk to someone once every couple years, I mean, I'm good, but I'm not that good, right? Like, it's you have to know somebody to really know what to do for them. And you know, I also have one of those brains where I might not be able to find my keys or remember your name, yeah, but I can remember a lot of health details about people. And so, you know, it's, you have to find someone that you resonate with. And I mean, finding the person that can help you is probably a first step. It might be someone local. You might consult with someone like myself on, you know, we do a lot of remote care for people. So you have to find the right person. And you are correct that not everyone has access to that. I mean, we're really fortunate to have the relationship that you and I do to be able to, help you with your health to the level we can. So, I mean, I really encourage people to, you know, open lines of communication with their doctor, make it very clear that they want to be, you know, above and beyond. Look for someone that does, you know, anti-aging type stuff, and think about your health from the standpoint of an investment. I mean, you need to invest in information so you can, you know, get everything that you potentially need. I mean, I like to sometimes give people lists of, this is a good general idea of what you should get, but it changes, right? And again, it changes with some of that health history and with what's going on with you right now. But like I said, you know, again, it's, you know, get some blood work done. You might even use a company like, you know, 23andMe to get some genetic information and then run it through a lot of these other sites that do, mm-hmm, spit out reports for you on what your genetics mean. Some are better than others. I don't like to really advocate or talk about one, yeah, particular one, because then it gets to be weird and sometimes those sites change and someone might be listening to this down the road when it's not the same as what I said right now. But, you know, there are a lot of sites that will take that information and then give you some of your health risks. And the one that 23andMe does a lot that I also chat a lot about in my practice is Alzheimer's disease. So they do apolipoprotein gene testing and it helps us understand whether or not you have that tendency. So it's, you know, there are things that you can do. So like you said, you weren't surprised when X problem came up and you knew what to do. So that's all this information is. You just have to know what your risk factors are.
A lot of people are hesitant to provide their DNA to a company, which we've seen now partner with GlaxoSmithKline, and there's a hesitancy to give that information to somebody like them. But it's also really hard to go to just a primary care doctor and say, run this, you know, these 500 tests on me and get these genetic results back. So tell me if you think this is good or bad. But I said, well, what one option you could do is use somebody like 23andMe and don't give them your real name because they don't need it. I actually was telling someone, well, use your PO box and use a fake name. And then you just know which one is assigned to who. But I think I'm like the downside to that is if you need that health information for something specific and you take it to your doctor and they're like, well, I can't tie this to you. Is that a problem? Where they're like, oh, I use Susie Smith and I'm taking it to you. And I'm like, these are my test results. And you're like, that's not your name.
Totally. Well, I mean, I think one, you're generally talking about doctors like myself. So if someone came into me and said, I used a fake name for my genetic testing because I wanted to keep my genetic information sacred, I'm gonna kind of tell you two things here. One, your genetic information as an individual isn't really what people are concerned about. I feel like I'm going to open a whole paranoid can of worms right now, but I'm just going to say it anyway. So the concern with people having biological information about human beings is like biological warfare, putting things in our food, all that kind of stuff. You as an individual, like nobody cares about you and your genetics. It's the pool of the whole genetic material we're providing that most people feel paranoid about. Like we don't want to give too much power to people. It's almost like a secret treasure map. Like here's a secret treasure map. And if you just alter this gene in all people, we could have all these problems. I'm personally not that paranoid as a person. I kind of feel like that's future Renee's problem. I'm not going to worry about it today because today's Renee has these problems and I have to worry about these problems. So I'm not paranoid about it. But you know, people who are evil, horrible people have been doing evil, horrible things since the beginning of time, right? Like you can't stop people from being crappy sometimes. I mean, whether we're talking about, you know, guns or biological warfare or anything else, people who choose to do negative things, we can't stop that. So I don't really know, that someone having your information specifically is really going to make much of a difference. That said, use a fake name if you feel like it. If it makes you feel better, great. I don't really care. But I think that, you know, from a disease prevention standpoint, the non-paranoid school of thought, which I come from, I think we could really help people a lot. The more information we have about most people's, you know, genetics. And I'm going to tell you guys like a dirty Dr. Young secret that I don't like to tell, but I'm going to anyway. So when I was a student clinician, I would go out on like a Thursday night usually, and I would drink a lot of booze. And then I would go the next morning to the student health clinic, either at my naturopathic college or at Yale, which was really close by, and they would pay me give them blood and do an exam. That's who your studies are being done on. How many of you guys are freaking going somewhere and how many of you guys go to Stanford or something locally and you're like, oh, I'm going to get paid $75 for 3 hours and let students poke me? Bullshit. So most studies and things are done on people who will, you know, get paid and they're, you know, half drunk college students, or we used to pull people from free clinics to do things. That's the reality of medicine. So if you want someone to really practice medicine on you, you need to know about you.
To kind of close this out, and I think you did a very good like wrap up earlier, and then I like interrupted. Find somebody that you can have a long-term relationship with, some sort of a doctor that is invested in getting to the root of the problem, who is either willing to run the blood work and the tests that you need, or find somebody else to do it and take them to them, whether you're doing a combination of hormonal tests from them, 23andMe, and just taking a good snapshot picture of what your health looks like and observing what happens to your body when you eat a certain way, when you eat at a certain time, when you eat too much carbs, when you eat too much sugar, and truly finding that balance and kind of happy medium. And you did mention that you do see people remotely, that you can send kits to their house. But that could be as like, I can't find anybody else who will run it for me. Let's at least do like, do that picture, that snapshot, help me get started, and then I'll find somebody local that can help me on a maintenance level.
Absolutely. And that's something both myself and the other doc that works for me in my office, Dr. Crystal, do for patients is that we provide you with a strategy and then give you advice on how to help your healthcare provider help you. So we act as that type of practitioner for patients. And then we also act as more long-term relationship care. And what you're kind of bringing up is, you know, like I, as a person, I love long-term relationships with people because I love to be able to really help you. Mm-hmm. But that said, I have lots of lovely people that I help with a strategy that they can then take back to their doc and say, here's my map. And then more long-term, this is what I need you to do. So for example, if I knew that your roadmap included, you have a tendency towards autoimmune thyroid conditions, I would give you like, here's the things that Hashimoto's patients right. should always test. Or if you had a tendency towards arthritis, these are the things you should always have tested so that you have a good idea moving forward. What do I need to monitor? And what's the timing on that? So, you know, my treatment plans always include with my patients a future plan right down to, you know, get your breast exam in a year, get your pap smear in 3 years, mm-hmm. get a colonoscopy in 10. Like I'm very specific about this is a timing of what you need to do and try to do my best to give patients reminders of that. Like, hey, it's time for you to do this because you have to have a health strategy if you want to make it to a ripe old age.
And with your doctor should be a partnership. It shouldn't be a hostile interaction. And I've talked before specifically about pediatricians, and I'm a little bit more like,
no.
You fire that doctor if they are, you know, trying to force things on you. But you don't necessarily want to be in that position where you're like, do this or you're fired. You want to be open-minded. But you want them to be open-minded as well, where you guys are working collaboratively together for something that works for you, that nobody feels like they're bossing the other one around.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's, again, I mean, talk about, I think you and I have talked about like 30 subjects we could do whole things on. I mean, in medicine, you know, again, it's like doctors, when patients tell me, I went to my doctor and I told them I'm going to use again, like that I wanted an MTHFR test and they said no. It's
yeah.
like, okay, well, I went to Pete's Coffee and I told them I wanted a hamburger and they said no. And I was pissed. Like, understand these are people that have a medical license that they have to be able to say,
right.
This is why they ordered something. They can't like commit insurance fraud or something and order things just because you feel like mm-hmm. it. Right. Like, and that's what I mean about you have sick care insurance. You don't have healthcare insurance. Sometimes you have to go outside of that and consult with someone that's able to do that with you and spend the time doing that and then come back to your doctor and just tell them like, hey, I found I had this gene and I did this research and this is what needs to be monitored. Can you help me with that? Instead of you need to do this for me or else like kind of thing, because you know, a lot of docs, you know, myself included, like we information moves very quickly. And trying to navigate that for every person, it's just not realistic. I'm like, I'm sure if you listen to something mm-hmm. I wrote or, you know, a recording I did 5 years ago, some of it's dated right now, right? It's no longer true. So, you know, just help educate your doctor and bring them like sound information. And this isn't me being, you know, judgy, but like, you know, don't confuse information with talking about like your medical medium and your horoscope or whatever the hell else you want to talk about. Just be factual. I found this out. I need you to help me with that. That's what that person is. That yeah. person isn't there to help you navigate everything you think about the world. Does that make sense? Like treat it. I'm talking about medical doctors too. I mean, if you want to tell me what your horoscope said, you can, it's entertaining to me, but like, I'm just saying like, I'm very, you know, I'm paid as an individual consultant. I don't take insurance. So for me, you can talk about whatever you want to with me. I'm not offended by any of it. I have a lot of good friends that are MDs and I love, love, love them. They're as frustrated with medicine as their patients are. Like, honestly, like a lot of them, unless you're a surgeon or you're like a dermatologist, like they have easy lives, but like a lot of other docs are just frustrated. I mean, you know, pediatricians are a great example. The pediatric office I was taking my son to, they started to have to act half as a concierge practice. They needed you to give them so much money per year to even be able to go and see them because their operating costs have gotten to be so high because medicine is run like a business. And I mean, particularly in California, you know, we're required to be a corporation, right? And we have to run like a corporation,
yeah.
but we're supposed to then be, you know, generous to people because it's their health. Does that make sense?
So I was kind of using them to, well, using them to really get what I needed and what they were willing to run for me. And I was taking it over to you for interpretation and actual life application. We will go ahead and wrap it up, and we'll see what, if anybody wants us to talk about.
I hope
about
you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Ray.
Thanks so much for coming on and chatting. And
I'll go ahead and link her website and her Instagram handle in the show notes of the podcast. You may be thinking that you could benefit from her expertise, someone who does a proper intake appointment to listen to all of your symptoms and take a full health history, factors in your environment and stress level and any and all of the above, but don't have access to somebody locally that can do that for you, and at least get a game plan, something in mind for you to move forward with. We know that she is available for that as well. And I know that she likes to pop onto her Instagram, and she does her stories once a day that she likes to share her fun tidbits. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation, our future conversation, and just her presence and knowledge in general.